Chapter 27. Ask me for a farewell letter in the name of the American people. Bless you, the joy of the American people is just a little premature. I haven't gone yet. And what is more, I am not going to stay when I do go. Yes, it is true. I am only going to remain beyond the sea 6 months, that is all. I love stir and excitement. And so the moment the spring birds begin to sing, and the lagging weariness of summer to threaten, I grow restless, I get the fidgets, I want to pack off somewhere, where there's something going on. But you know how that is, you must have felt that way. This very day I saw the signs in the air of the coming dullness, and I said to myself, how glad I am that I have already chartered a steamship. There was absolutely nothing in the morning papers. You can see for yourself what the telegraphic headings were. By telegraph, a father killed by his son, a bloody fight in Kentucky, a courthouse fired, and Negroes therein shot, while escaping, a Louisiana massacre, an 80-year-old murderer, 200 to 300 men roasted alive. A town in a state of general riot, a lively skirmish in Indiana, and 30 other similar headings. The items under those headings all bear date yesterday, Ab. 16, refer to your own paper, and I give you my word of honor that that string of commonplace stuff was everything there was in the telegraphic columns that a body could call news. Well, said I to myself, this is getting pretty dull, this is getting pretty dry, there don't appear to be anything going on anywhere. Has this progressive nation gone to sleep? Have I got to stand another month of this torpidity before I can begin to browse among the lively capitals of Europe? But never mind, things may revive while I am away. During the last 2 months my next door neighbor, Charles Dudley Warner, has dropped his Aglog studies, and he and I have written a bulky novel in partnership. He has worked up the fiction and I have hurled in the facts. I consider it one of the most astonishing novels that ever was written. Night after night I sit up reading it over and over again and crying. It will be published early in the fall, with plenty of pictures. Do you consider this an advertisement? And if so, do you charge for such things when a man is your friend? Yours truly, SAML. 50. Clemens, Ark Twain. An amusing, even if annoying, incident happened about the time of Mark Twain's departure. A man named Chew related to Twitchell a most entertaining occurrence. Twitchell saw great possibilities in it, and suggested that Mark Twain be allowed to make a story of it, sharing the profits with Chew. Chew agreed, and promised to send the facts, carefully set down. Twitchell, in the meantime, told the story to Clemens, who was delighted with it, and strongly tempted to write it at once, while he was in the spirit, without waiting on Chew. Fortunately, he did not do so, for when Chew's material came it was in the form of a clipping, the story having been already printed in some newspaper. Chew's knowledge of literary ethics would seem to have been slight. He thought himself entitled to something under the agreement with Twitchell. Mark Twain, by this time in London, naturally had a different opinion. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. London, June 9, 73. Dear old Joe, I consider myself wholly at liberty to decline to pay you anything, and at the same time strongly tempted to sue him into the bargain for coming so near ruining me. If he hadn't happened to send me that thing in print, I would have used the story like an innocent fool, and would straightway have been hounded to death as a plagiarist. It would have absolutely destroyed me. I cannot conceive of a man being such a hopeless ass after serving as a legislative reporter, to imagine that I or any other literary man in his senses would consent to chew over old stuff that had already been in print. If that man weren't an infant in swaddling clothes, his only reply to our petition would have been, it has been in print. It makes me as mad as the very old Harry every time I think of Mr. Chew, and the frightfully narrow escape I have had at his hands. Confound Mr. Chew, with all my heart. I'm willing that he should have $10 for his trouble of warming over his cold victuals, cheerfully willing to that, but no more. If I had had him near when his letter came, I would have got out my tomahawk and gone for him. He didn't tell the story half as well as you did, anyhow. I wish to goodness he were here this moment, nobody in our parlor, but Livy and me, and a very good view of London to the fore. We have a luxuriously ample suite of apartments in the Langham Hotel, third floor, our bedroom looking straight up Portland Place, and our parlor having a noble array of great windows looking out upon both streets, Portland Place and the crook that joins it to Regent Street. 9 p.m. Full twilight, rich sunset tints lingering in the west. I am not going to write anything, rather tell it when I get back. I love you and Harmony, and that is all the fresh news I've got, anyway. And I mean to keep that fresh all the time. Lovingly, Mark. P.S. I'm luxuriating in glorious old Peepy's diary, and smoking. Letters are exceedingly scarce through all this period. Mark Twain, now on his second visit to London, was literally overwhelmed with honors and entertainment. His rooms at the Langham were like a court. Such men as Robert Browning, Turgenev, Sir John Millais, and Charles Kingsley hastened to call. Kingsley and others gave him dinners. Mrs. Clemens to her sister, wrote : it is perfectly discouraging to try to write you. The continuous excitement presently told on her. In July all further engagements were cancelled, and Clemens took his little family to Scotland for quiet and rest. They broke the journey at York, and it was there that Mark Twain wrote the only letter remaining from this time. Part of a letter to Mrs. Jervis Langdon, of Elmira, N.Y. For the present we shall remain in this queer old walled town, with its crooked, narrow lanes, that tell us of their old day, that knew no wheeled vehicles, its plaster and timber dwellings, with upper stories far overhanging the street, and thus marking their date, say 300 years ago, the stately city walls, the castellated gates, the ivy-grown, foliage-sheltered, most noble and picturesque ruin of St. Mary's Abbey, suggesting their date, say 500 years ago, in the heart of crusading times, and the glory of English chivalry and romance. The vast cathedral of York, with its worn carvings and quaintly pictured windows, preaching of still remoter days, the outlandish names of streets and courts and byways, that stand as a record and a memorial, all these centuries, of Danish dominion here in still earlier times, the hint here and there of King Arthur, and his knights and their bloody fights with Saxon oppressors round about this old city more than 1300 years gone by. And, last of all, the melancholy old stone coffins and sculptured inscriptions, a venerable arch and a hoary tower of stone, that still remain, and are kissed by the sun, and caressed by the shadows every day, just as the sun and the shadows have kissed, and caressed them every lagging day since the Roman Emperor's soldiers placed them here in the times, when Jesus the Son of Mary walked the streets of Nazareth a youth, with no more name or fame than the Yorkshire boy who is loitering down this street this moment. Their destination was Edinburgh, where they remained a month. Mrs. Clemens' health gave way on their arrival there, and her husband, knowing the name of no other physician in the place, looked up Dr. John Brown, author of Rab and His Friends, and found in him not only a skillful practitioner, but a lovable companion, to whom they all became deeply attached. Little Susie, now 17 months old, became his special favorite. He named her Megalops, because of her great eyes. Mrs. Clemens regained her strength and they returned to London. Clemens, still urged to lecture, finally agreed with George Dolby to a week's engagement, and added a promise that after taking his wife and daughter back to America he would return immediately for a more extended course. Dolby announced him to appear at the Queen's Concert Rooms, Hanover Square, for the week of October 13-18, his lecture to be the old Sandwich Islands talk that 7 years before had brought him his first success. The great hall, the largest in London, was thronged at each appearance, and the papers declared that Mark Twain had no more than whetted the public appetite for his humor. 3 days later, October 1873, Clemens, with his little party, sailed for home. Halfway across the ocean he wrote the friend they had left in Scotland. To Dr. John Brown, in Edinburgh. Mid-Atlantic, October 30, 1873. Our dear friend the doctor, we have plowed a long way over the sea, and there's 2,200 miles of restless water between us now, besides the railway stretch. And yet you are so present with us, so close to us, that a span and a whisper would bridge the distance. The first 3 days were stormy, and wife, child, maid, and Miss Spaulding were all seasick 25 hours out of the 24, and I was sorry I ever started. However, it has been smooth, and balmy, and sunny and altogether lovely for a day or two now, and at night there is a broad luminous highway stretching over the sea to the moon, over which the spirits of the sea are traveling up and down all through the secret night, and having a genuine good time, I make no doubt. Today they discovered a ollie on board. I find, as per advertisement which I sent you, that they won't carry dogs in these ships at any price. This one has been concealed up to this time. Now his owner has to pay L10, or heave him overboard. Fortunately the doggy is a performing doggy, and the money will be paid. So after all it was just as well you didn't interest your collie to us. A poor little child died at midnight, and was buried at dawn this morning sheeted and shotted, and sunk in the middle of the lonely ocean in water 3,000 fathoms deep. Pity the poor mother. With our love. S. 50. Clemens. Mark Twain was back in London, lecturing again at the Queen's Concert Rooms, after barely a month's absence. Charles Warren Stoddard, whom he had known in California, shared his apartment at the Langham, and acted as his secretary, a very necessary office, for he was besieged by callers and bombarded with letters. He remained in London 2 months, lecturing steadily at Hanover Square to full houses. It is unlikely that there is any other platform record to match it. One letter of this period has been preserved. It is written to Twitchell, near the end of his engagement. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. London, January 5, 1874. My dear old Joe, I knew you would be likely to graduate into an ass if I came away, and so you have if you have stopped smoking. However, I have a strong faith that it is not too late, yet, and that the judiciously managed influence of a bad example will fetch you back again. I wish you had written me some news. Livy tells me precious little. She mainly writes to hurry me home, and to tell me how much she respects me. But she's generally pretty slow on news. I had a letter from her along with yours today, but she didn't tell me the book is out. However, it's all right. I hope to be home 20 days from today, and then I'll see her, and that will make up for a whole year's dearth of news. I am right down grateful that she is looking strong, and ovelier than ever. I only wish I could see her look her level best, once. I think it would be a vision. I have just spent a good part of this day browsing through the Royal Academy exhibition of Landseer's paintings. They fill 4 or 5 great salons, and must number a good many hundreds. This is the only opportunity ever to see them, because the finest of them belong to the Queen, and she keeps them in her private apartments. Ah, they're wonderfully beautiful. There are such rich moonlights and dusks in the challenge and the combat, and in that long flight of birds across a lake in the subdued flush of sunset or sunrise, for no man can ever tell t'other from which in a picture, except that as the filmy morning mist breathing itself up from the water, and there is such a grave analytical profundity in the faces of the connoisseurs, and such pathos in the picture of the fawn suckling its dead mother, on a snowy waste, with only the blood in the footprints to hint that she is not asleep. And the way he makes animals absolute flesh and blood, insomuch that, if the room were darkened ever so little, and a motionless living animal placed beside a painted one, no man could tell which was which. I interrupted myself here to drop a line to Shirley Brooks and suggest a cartoon for Punch. It was this. In one of the Academy salons in the suite where these pictures are, a fine bust of Landseer stands on a pedestal in the center of the room. I suggest that some of Landseer's best-known animals be represented as having come down out of their frames in the moonlight and grouped themselves about the bust in mourning attitudes. Well, old man, I am powerful glad to hear from you, and shall be powerful glad to see you and Harmony. I am not going to the provinces, because I cannot get halls that are large enough. I always felt cramped in Hanover Square rooms, but I find that everybody here speaks with awe and respect of that prodigious place, and wonder that I could fill it so long. I am hoping to be back in 20 days, but I have so much to go home to, and enjoy with a jubilant joy, that it seems hardly possible that it can ever come to pass in so uncertain a world as this. I have read the novel The Gilded Age, published during his absence, December, 1873. Here, and I like it. I have made no inquiries about it, though. My interest in a book ceases with the printing of it. With a world of love, SAML. Z. Letters 1874. Hartford and Elmira. A New Study. Beginning Om Sawyer. The Sellers Play. Naturally Redpath would not give him any peace now. His London success must not be wasted. At first his victim refused point blank, and with great brevity. But he was overborne and persuaded, and made occasional appearances, wiring at last this final defiant word. Telegram to James Redpath, in Boston. Hartford, March 3, 1874. James Redpath, why don't you congratulate me? I never expect to stand on a lecture platform again after Thursday night. Mark. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.